Well, I want to welcome you to our Sunday morning live stream worship service here at New Life and thank Minister Chris for his heartfelt prayer this morning. I am pushing back the First Peter series, second time now, so I think I'm learning my lesson not to tell you what's going to be preached next week, so or pretty soon. No one's going to believe me, but I felt the need to push it back, as you have heard and felt through the prayer, that there are things going on in our country that I felt like we should talk about from the pulpit, but even more importantly, amongst ourselves. If you've seen the video of George Floyd, the black gentleman who's life was literally squeezed out on camera by people who were supposed to protect and to serve. And the part of it is that there are other police and crowd around, and he lost his life. Many of you may have seen the video. It's deeply disturbing. And in response, the number of communities, black communities as well, have demonstrated, is protesting throughout the cities in our country, over a dozen or more, and it seems like it's just increasing. So, you know, Friday night, as I kept hearing the news and what was going on, I felt the need to change the topic. Because on the same day in Central Park, New York City, a white woman was walking her dog without a leash in a part of Central Park that's supposed to be a bird sanctuary where dogs were supposed to be leased. And when a black gentleman asked her to do so, she refused. And I think he started filming her, at which point she threatened to call the police and did call the police. But if you listen to the dialogue, the emphasis upon his blackness, I mean, this was a threat, not just calling the police, but it was a threat of using the power dynamics within our institution of policing to threaten him. And that was disturbing in its own way. And all of this comes after the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery out in Georgia just a few weeks ago, or come to light a few weeks ago, out jogging, and then many of you may not have heard of Breonna Taylor, a black woman, EMT, who's working towards becoming a nurse, and Louisville police had broken into the wrong home looking for drug dealers and shot her 8 times, and that's coming to light. And all of this is coming, and I think there's been a history, obviously, but it's the intensity of it these days. I felt like that we needed to start a dialogue. And my desire is to make aware, and many of you are, but to begin a discussion and dialogue amongst ourselves and to see what does it mean to be Americans who are not white, not black, but believers who ought to be concerned. What does it mean for us, individuals in our neighborhood, but as a church in our neighborhood as well? And so I've made the switch to the topic. And so the theme for this sermon is on power, how power is often used to privilege one group over another. As I was writing the title of this sermon, I, you know, once again, I'm reminded of my privileged position as a male. Even our language is male-oriented. You know, the call of brotherhood, I think you can see it on the screen, the call of brotherhood is supposed to cover all of humanity. And this is especially the case with our church world, that I get to stand up here and preach the sermon is a privilege that I enjoy that many female pastors in the evangelical world do not. I continually remind my daughter, Rachel, who's studying at Princeton Theological Seminary, that if she becomes a pastor, her opportunities will be limited. And I've read several of her sermons. I saw her preach online And I tell you, it's a proud father that I speak, but more so as a fellow preacher, her content is far better than mine. It's far more eloquent. She has ways with words. And yet, because she's female, she will not have the opportunities that I do, even at our church. And so I left sisterhood in parentheses. If you look at the title, it's sisterhood in parentheses, as a reminder how often we forget about the half of our population, that they are an afterthought, a second generation, an inferior gender. So with that background, this morning we're considering Cain and Abel, a story that we're quite familiar with. In this story, we have the first images of how Adam and Eve's catastrophic choice has affected the world God has created. In this scene, we have the prototype of all social evils, how privileging of the powerful comes at the cost of the weak. Just as Adam and Eve represent every man and woman as they ate the fruit in the Garden of Eden, so in the same way, Cain and Abel represents every social interaction where power becomes the key determinant for who lives and who dies, who enjoys and who suffers, who controls and who serves. In Cain, we have the embryonic life force of all the Nazi Germanys, the southern slave owners, and the Spanish conquistadors. And in Abel, we have represented the anguish of the Jews, the black slaves, and the natives of the exploited lands. And so we want to explore this story to see what God has for us today. And so we want to read the text, and it's on the screen. And if you want to pull out your Bibles, you're welcome to do so as well. But I ask that the familiarity of the story do not detract from what I think God is trying to say to us through the text. So verse 1, Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now, I've highlighted it because the writer is trying to do something here. You have pairs, Cain, Abel, okay? And now look at the next verse. Now Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the ground. Notice the reversal of the name order there. Okay. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. And Abel, this is the third pair, once again reversed, brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain, this is the fourth pair, reversed once again. So Cain was very angry and his face was downcast. Now the story focuses on Cain here, verse 6. And the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at the door. It desires to have you, but you must fight it. You must rule over it." Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." And while they're in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where's your brother?" Now here we have three pairs of the name, but in each one, Cain's comes first. It's privileged. And then his famous line, "I don't know where he is," he replied, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Verse 10, the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand." Verse 12, "When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crop for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." Verse 13, Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence, and I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Verse 15, "But the Lord said to him, 'Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over.' Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden." May God bless the reading and the preaching of his word. In our reading of the text, Cain and Abel starts out as equals. Neither holds greater privilege or power. Both are born of the same parents. Both are engaged in equally respectable occupations. In fact, their vocations complement one another. The tiller of the ground needs the keeper of the sheep, and the shepherd needs the farmer. Remove one, and society is out of sync. Respect both, and society is enriched. And both offer equally acceptable sacrifices to God. Both animal and fruit sacrifices are acceptable. Even narratively, the text affirms equality by placing neither name in positions of privilege. Both are necessary, both are equal, and both together enrich. That is, until the scene of the murder. Three pairs. In each pair, Cain's name comes first. The way the writer arranges the names is a textual clue that Cain is asserting privilege over Abel, not because of his character or what he has done, but because of his place of birth. Society is structured in such a way that the firstborn is given greater power and resources over all the other siblings. More blessing, double the inheritance. This is systemic biasness, a cultural privileging of one over the other. We find this inequality in the names given. So you can only imagine the exuberance of Eve as she gives birth to a son. She is called the mother of the living, right? That's how she is named. And she has fulfilled her calling by giving birth. So when the firstborn comes, his name is Cain, which means to produce or to bring forth. His name complements her name. The mother of the living has produced life. There's harmony. But when the second son is born, his name suggests a level of routineness. The enthusiasm is muted. For the name Abel means breath or vapor, transience, worthless, or nothingness. Not an auspicious beginning for the middle child. There's no doubt who was favored by Adam and Eve. No doubt who was inferior. Not because of who he is, but what he is. Every society is structured in such a way that some are privileged and others are not. As we saw last week, it is the curse of the fall that Adam's pursuit of power by trying to become like God has now been passed down to his pursuit of trying to control those around us, especially those who are different. Power becomes the means of alleviating fear to dominate, to suppress, and oppress. In fact, in this text, there are already clues of oppression, not against Cain and Abel so much, but man against woman. Even in the narration of the story, none of the females are named. Now, I am certain that Adam and Eve had female children, but they're not named because they're not worth the naming, because they do not have the same value as a son. This inequality is found in every society. In fact, when we do first names of daughters comes in this passage in chapter 4. So you'll see this in the screen, slide 1. So in Genesis chapter 4, verse 23, Lamech's wife, first time daughters are named, Ada, which means ornament, and Zillah, which means shadow. Notice that Ada, ornament, is like a trophy wife. She's eye candy, window dressing, someone who increases the status of the husband. And Zillah is named Shadow. She is a shadow to her husband, his trusty servant, ever present to cater to his needs. Both wives are named in relation to their husband without an identity of their own. And you should have caught it, you know, the creation account, that the marriage is between a man and a woman. Where in this story did it suddenly become a man gets to marry multiple wives? Because the woman is the weaker vessel who must seek refuge in a man, even at the cost of her identity, at the cost of her dignity, even at the cost of violence. Do you know that over 1 million women in America alone will stay in marriages despite domestic abuse? You know, I remember reading an article where the coronavirus, where we have a coronavirus birth or a coronavirus divorces. And what came out was we had coronavirus physical abuse as husbands and wives were quarantined together. Over 300,000 rape reported rapes annually in the United States, yet the disappearance of or backlog of thousands of rape kits in storage facilities across the United States. This is not some other country, third world nation. In the United States, we lose thousands of rape kits throughout our police stations. Perhaps that is an indication of how little we care. Before racism, there was sexism. But it's not just a male-dominated society that we live in. It's also a world where whiteness has its privileges. Like the firstborn of a family, our culture is structured so that being white is better than being black. When European colonizers went out into the unknown world, they saw themselves as the elect of God. Israel was rejected by God. It's been replaced by European Christians. And as God's elect, they felt called to rule and subdue the world, Genesis 1, 26, 27. Just as Israel was called to settle the land of Canaan, and just like Israel, violence was justified. Did not God command it? And so the stated goal was to civilize, and the subtext was to exploit them. If you look at slide number 2, what you have there is a cartoon pictorial of Rudyard Kipling. That's the author of The Jungle Book. It's called The White Man's Burden, and it was published in the magazine to encourage the United States to annex the Philippines because these barbarians needed to be civilized. Look at the slide. This is the burden of whiteness, to take those who are savages. Look at the dark screens. They're lower. Higher up is the Asians. That's us. But they're on their way to civilization. It is the white man's burden to bring civilization to the rest of the world. One way to exploit how a people group views itself is by examining their interpretation of their God. It is interesting that virtually all visual representations of Jesus has been white since the Reformation period, even though he is of dark-skinned Middle Easterner. So if you look at slide 3, you see the pictures of Jesus with the Western features and the lighter skin, and the one in the middle is found in almost every Asian household. And what's more fascinating is the pictures of God. I can understand drawing pictures of Jesus because he's incarnated, but pictures of God himself, who is invisible, is depicted as being white. If you look at slide number 4, you see the consistent pictorial of him being white. And then soon after the Enlightenment, if you look at slide number 5, you see pictures of Adam and Eve in the garden in their pristine state before they ate the fruit. You see them as being white. And slide number 5, continue to slide number 6, because being white is better. I come across YouTube clips of Asian women. So I've been on this kick of watching Asian videos, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, on all different topics, economic, culture, and things. And I came across this clip of Indians as well, of this obsession. So if you look at slide number 7, you see this obsession of becoming more white. It started out of Korea. As most of you know, that Korea is obsessed with beauty, physical beauty. We are the cosmetic surgery capital of the world. And $20 billion a year is spent on whitening creams, pills that you can take, laser treatments, even surgery to become whiter. And so this interviewer is asking these Koreans and these Indians as well. And the answer is consistent all throughout the Southeast Asia area. Why do you want to be whiter? And their response is, because when you're whiter, you're seen as being more successful, more wealthy. You're seen as being more desirable, having more important jobs than those who have darker skin. And it's just not there. It's in our country as well. So that you have seen slide number 8, the Dove commercial, where they were consistently criticized for placing a blackness and associating it with before cleanliness, with whiteness after. You also see it in commercials from different parts of the world. I'm going to show you one that's about 45 seconds long from a Chinese detergent company. what you see in the commercial there is something that's true without boundaries, all around the country, all around the world. I mean, I'm part of I'm Korean, and you know, most of our parents and immigrants, they came to this country and they opened small businesses, grocery stores, cosmetic beauty shops, vegetable stores, carryouts in the inner city. And there's a long tradition of conflict and racism between Koreans and blacks in the urban areas as well. It's everywhere we look. We come back to the story of Cain and Abel. The rabbinic commentaries on this passage believe that Cain, as the firstborn, received a greater share of the resources and the land, that he was a wealthy man, a powerful man, a man of status, someone who believed that he could get away with murder. So Cain brings his offering to the Lord. Abel brings portions of fat from the firstborn of his flock to the Lord. And God looks upon favor with Abel's, but not with Cain's offering. The reason the text is not explicit, but most commentators think that Abel's sacrifice cost him more. Not that it was better, but that it cost him more than Cain's. Abel is like the widow who dropped 2 pennies in the offering in the temple. And Jesus sees that and says to the disciples, look, see that widow? She has given more than all the wealthy who has given their offering. And perhaps for the first time, Cain experiences a reversal of status. According to the hierarchy of the world, Cain as firstborn is on the top. According to the rules of the culture, Cain being male meant he had the winning hand. Cain being wealthy meant that he is used to a certain level of respect. He's used to being privileged. But God interrupts this plan with a set of rules that upend the status quo. Not how much you have, but how much you give. How much does it cost you? And those who were used to coming out first got to taste the sourness of being last. It's Abel first, Cain second before God, and Cain did not like it. He was faced with two options. He could have died to the value system of this world, transferred his allegiance from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light, and he could have looked upon Abel as an inspiration, as a model of how one ought to relate to God, to offer your very best, to live before God and not in the eyes of man. But Cain does not take the narrow path. He takes the broader road of conformity. He asserts his privilege by using power to oppress the weak, to reestablish his status as the one who is on top. So he leads Abel out into the field, kills his brother. Why? Because divine verdict had affirmed Abel over Cain. Abel's existence was a constant reminder to Cain that Abel could no longer be the nobody that affirmed Cain's somebodyness. God has forever ruined that. Stay with me here. In every hierarchy, there's always someone on the bottom rung. And if your sense of identity comes from the world's value structure, then you need the bottom feeders to give you your sense of importance. The untouchables in the caste system is a reminder to the rest that they are worthy of being touched. Without the bottom feeders, you do not know who you are. You lose a sense of self. Because a firstborn without a secondborn is not truly a firstborn. And Abel was no longer a secondborn because God had given him a new identity, given him a new name, the one that is favored by God. And God made him a somebody. And when God affirmed Abel, Cain lost his identity. And instead of reframing his identity heavenward, Cain cashed out of the divine economy completely. No more pretending, no more straddling the fence. He commits the ultimate crime in order to find himself and thereby ultimately lose himself. He seeks to save his own life, Jesus says. And he's lost it. That's Cain. By killing his brother, he loses his sense of brotherhood. By having the land cursed, he loses his sense of calling. By being expelled from the land, he loses his familial connections. By being cursed, he loses God. And he becomes a wanderer on the earth, a man without a home. a man without a place to belong. This interpretation of the Cain and Abel story is similar to what happened at the end of the Civil War. Virtually all Southern whites saw themselves as superior to blacks. They were the masters in every way. The blacks were inferior in every way. But after the war ended, Northern powers came in and overturned the Southern hierarchy. And for a time, especially during the Reconstruction period, the black person was elevated above the Southern white. They were given unprecedented access to education, placed in positions of power. You have black governors, House of Representatives for a time. And in some ways, losing the war was easier to swallow for the Southern whites than having former slaves rule over you. You can always rebuild your nation, but the elevation of the blacks meant that you were no longer you no longer had bottom feeders who gave you a sense of identity, your importance, your value. And that was a much tougher pill to swallow. In due time, however, the Northern political systems needed to woo the Southern white vote. And the price of their loyalty was to leave the Southerners alone in the way that they dealt with the blacks living in the South. And it turned out to be a tremendously costly price. For one could argue that the vengeance of retaliation was almost worse than being a slave, because thousands of men and boys, black men and boys, were arrested for minor charges like loitering and thrown in prison work gangs to restart the Southern economy. Millions were placed in sharecropper types of situations where they could barely eke out a meal or two a day. Slavery by a different name. Segregation. Jim Crow law. And the worst of all was the public lynching. Almost 5,000 blacks were lynched between the late 1800s to the early 1900s. By one estimate, there was a lynching every 4 days in the United States. For offenses allegedly as minor as jumping prison work gangs, looking at a woman, a white woman, in the wrong way, for being uppity, for insulting a white person. If you look at slide number 9, it is one of the most inhumane ways of killing someone: to string them up, to ridicule them, to pierce their bodies, to hang them, and then ultimately to burn them. And these lynchings were public spectacles. You know, kids were allowed to skip school to attend the viewing. Shard pieces of flesh were cut off, sliced off on their bodies to become souvenirs. Entire families would bring picnic baskets to be entertained, and the photographers would take pictures of these lynchings and then turn them into postcards and send them around the world. This Cain did not even need to take Abel out into the field. You could do it in broad daylight. And we have been dealing with the residual effects of systemic oppression to this very day. So if you look at slide number 10, the black man are 3 times more likely to be killed by police, even though they are less number of blacks, black men are armed. Then in one estimate, in 2015, 40% of all men shot to death were black, while they made up 6% men of the national population. The likelihood of incarceration, slide number 9, or 11, slide number 11. You see that among all males, there's a 1 in 9 chance of being arrested, but if you're black, or if you're white, it's 1 in 17, but if you're black, it's 1 in 3. If you're Latino, 1 in 6. I don't think this is just individual personality disposition or choice. Yes, that's part of it. But when the numbers are this disproportionate, there's a systemic biasness going on. Did you know, slide number 12, that if you're a black man arrested for a crime that a white person commits, the same crime, that you are 19% more likely, you're sentenced 19.5 years longer than whites? If you look at slide number 13, you have a different essay, 19.1. The blacks are sentenced longer than whites for the same crimes. And then last week I talked about the education system, and it's if you look at slide 14, the education system and how its property values, where there's a perpetual generational, you could say systemic, inability to get your children educated, which results in the income, disproportionate of income, and you can see how disproportionate that is from the chart. And then if you look at slide 15, just that highlighted part, 3 to 4 times black mothers are likely to die in hospitals giving birth than white women. I'm not sure what are the conditions for that are. I do know that, as most of you do, that during the coronavirus period, that blacks are disproportionately sick and dying, and I don't know what the exact causes are. I just mention it. But it seems like the sins of the past are continually catching up for our country, for my country. Please do not misunderstand my point here, and I'm done with all the slides. Please do not misunderstand my point here. I hope no one walks away from this online stream service thinking that any race or ethnicity or gender or skin tone is inherently evil. It's not. I remember reading Ta-Nehisi's quotes, letter to his teenage son, The World Between Us, which has become quite well known, about being black and being born, living black, being raised black in America. And the author wanted to convey his experiences of racism and his insights to his son. And so he wrote this memoir. And he says that he started to notice something within himself. There's a strong tendency not only to speak out against injustice against blacks, but also a tendency to demonize whites and white culture. But then when he started learning African culture, he saw how blacks were just as oppressive as whites. And what little I know of Asian history, Asians have been oppressive of other Asians as well. You see, there's a fine line between fighting injustice for the sake of the weak and demonizing the culprit. To cross that line is to maintain the us-them distinction, but merely flip it. And that's just as wrong. The passage does not suggest that Cain is inherently evil. He made evil choices, yes. He's experiencing the residual effects of the fall, yes. But it's not his skin color or ethnicity or maleness that makes him evil. It's power. In a fallen world, the only way we know how to use power is to abuse it. It doesn't matter whether it's the police or the mob or whether you're white or Asian or black. We are all fallen. In fact, toward the end of the story, God has to step in and protect Cain from those who are more powerful than him. Because issue is not race. The point of the passage is that we are all potential Cains. Just as we are all potential Adams. Yeah, do I think I would not have eaten the fruit? Do you think if I wasn't Cain, I would not have done something similar to able to protect my sense of who I am? We are all sinners, Paul writes, both Jews and Gentiles, black and white. And given enough power and the wrong opportunity, we all have the potential of raising our hands to strike down our brothers, to strike down our sisters. If history had been different, it could have been the blacks lynching the whites, Jews committing genocide against the Germans, women marrying multiple husbands. It is power that structures society, and society is always structured to favor those who have it. And this is the call of God, to stand for those who happen to be oppressed in our generation, during our time. Perhaps this is why, during the early days of biblical history, God seemed to bestow disproportionate favor upon the second born, upon the youngest. Have you ever wondered why he seems to choose the younger over the older consistently? We see this not only with Abel over Cain, but Isaac over Ishmael, Jacob over Esau, Judah over Reuben, Perez over Hurah, and the most famous of all, a little shepherd boy is chosen over his seven older brothers. Perhaps God is making a statement here that he continually chooses the younger over the older, the lesser over the greater, because he stands for those who have been oppressed by society's power structures. And the church should too. I do not know what this means for me. I do not know what it means for you. And I do not know what it means for our church New Life. I just know that you cannot remain silent any longer. For if we are to follow the one who gave up divine privilege, that he might humble himself to the point of death, even death by lynching on a cross, you cannot be silent. In my last year of my tenure at Moody Bible Institute, we had two incidents where someone had carved out or scraped a swastika on our campus. Now, Moody has a Jewish studies program with a number of Messianic Jews who come and attend. And for the Jew, the swastika evokes the same memory and fear and anxiety as the lynching rope for the black. And there was this general sense of horror on campus that perhaps it was one of the students who had done it. And so letters of support for the Jewish community started appearing in the student newspaper. Students voiced their disgust in the classrooms and in public venues. And I still remember the Black Student Association and the Hispanic Student Association both sending out letters to the school newspaper condemning this racist act. Except for the Korean Student Association. Depending on the year, they were either the largest or second largest ethnic group, yet they did not speak out. Every Friday afternoon, they gathered together in this one large classroom and they would sing songs and listen to a sermon given by a local pastor. They would eat Korean food. I know because they're just two doors from my office and I could hear them on a Friday night. They were a model community. They did all the right things, didn't cause any trouble, got the highest grades. They were the nicest people. And they were also silent. As though it did not concern them. If it doesn't concern them as Americans, then it should surely concern them as Christians. That if we are members of the Church of Christ, it is a concern for all of us. And so my desire here this morning in preaching this sermon isn't to like come up with this grand plan. We're not there. But at least to begin the dialogue amongst ourselves and Bible studies. I mean, when's the last time we talked about racism as a Bible study or even in a sermon? To begin the dialogue, to talk and share. I mean, Asians have been abused in minor ways in the last 2 months. And I read the stories, and I think Russell Jewell of San Francisco is collecting all of these, and people being spit upon and taunted and all of these and saying, you're not Americans. Yeah, we begin to share our collective experiences and then jump to those who are oppressed even more than we are, begin the dialogue, and then empathize, share the pain as Brother Chris has prayed. It begins when we weep with those who weep. And then we cry out to God, Lord, what does it mean to be my brother's keeper here in this area? Why is it that you have left us in this area? And then begin seeking his kingdom and his righteousness in this zip code. May God bless the reading and preaching of his word. Heavenly Father, we come to you this morning and we ask that your spirit would just take all the news that's been coming out, all the prayers, all our personal experiences. Lord, take your word and secondarily this sermon and begin to work in each individual lives so that when we come together face to face one day in the near future, that we would be of the same heart, that we must speak out. We must begin to weep, pray, and then do something. For we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.